I'm not sure what that was. We did not change our introduction music. Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On December 31st, 2011, President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act, codifying indefinite military detention without charge or trial into law for the first time in American history. According to the ACLU, the NDAA's dangerous detention provisions would authorize the president and all future presidents to order the military to pick up and indefinitely imprison people captured anywhere in the world. On May 16th, District Judge Catherine Forrest in Manhattan overturned that provision. The lawsuit was filed by activists and journalists who said they feared being detained. Judge Catherine Forrest said that it was in the public interest to reconsider the law so that, quote, ordinary citizens are able to understand the scope of conduct that could subject them to indefinite military detention, end quote. So how is the NDAA affecting our right to protest? What questions do you have about it? Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and others filed the lawsuit to overturn the NDAA, alleging that it violates both their free speech and associational rights guaranteed by the First Amendment, as well as due process rights guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment. Daniel Ellsberg is a former U.S. military analyst who released the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and other newspapers in 1971, and he was part of this lawsuit. Hi, Daniel. Welcome back to the show. Oh, we're still trying to get Daniel. We're also joined by Shahid Batar, a civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, a national nonprofit which defends the rule of law and rights and liberties challenged by overbroad national security and counterterrorism policies. And Shahid joins me here in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rose.
It's great to have you. So why don't you give us an update? Because the NDAA, it gets some attention here and there, but not as much as you'd expect. So first of all, just tell us what this law actually does.
Sure. The NDAA is passed every year. It's one of these bills that in D.C. we describe as a must-pass law because it's the bill that allows the Pentagon to spend money that Congress authorizes for it. This year... which is to say in the 2011 legislative year, Congress included a pair of provisions that are, quite frankly, authoritarian. They enable the military to detain even U.S. citizens captured within the U.S. without trial indefinitely. And what that means is we've basically thrown the presumption of innocence overboard and now have a statute on the books that enables detention on the basis of accusation without evidence.
And can you elaborate on what this means? Because when it passed, there was a lot of confusion over that specific provision.
Absolutely. And in fact, in the first round of the legislative debate, there was so much confusion that the White House, the Pentagon, the FBI, the Director of National Intelligence, pretty much everyone in D.C. who deals with counterterrorism opposed the NDAA. And there was a veto threat at one point that the president would veto the Authorization Act, which is, you know, quite frankly, unfathomable to most people in the defense establishment. Unfortunately, what emerged from the legislative sausage-making process is not far from its worst apogee. So there is a section to which many members of Congress have pointed, Section 1021E, which seems to ameliorate the ways in which it could be abused. It basically says that nothing in this law is going to change the existing laws or authorities that to this point had been established. The existing laws or authorities, though, include military detention without trial. To that point, we had done it exactly once to a U.S. citizen, to Jose Padilla, who'd been picked up at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago, I think in 2003 or 2004, held in a military brig for 3 years. And on the eve of his eventual hearing before the Supreme Court, the Bush administration said, oh, just kidding, we didn't mean it, we'll go ahead and charge you. Mm. And the set of charges had no relation to the accusations for which he was detained. And by that point, you know, Mr. Padilla basically lost his mind in solitary confinement. And the question now, you know, before Congress, when it was considering the NDAA, is are we going to put our stamp of approval on that or not? And Congress, in the same year that we finally kill Osama bin Laden, in the same year that the Arab Spring happens, right, and in Egypt they're contending against a military detention authority, we in the United States welcome it. It's the high watermark of the war on terror. It makes the Patriot Act look like a school funding bill. You know, this is easily the most authoritarian law that's perhaps ever been considered in the United States. It's worse than the Japanese internment, and that it could include that as well as political roundups. I mean, the NDAA is a sort of Damocles hanging over our democracy.
But what could you be picked up for? Can you give us some real-life examples?
That's exactly the question that Judge Forrest asked the Justice Department in the case that Daniel and Chris Hedges and others had filed. And the Justice Department basically could not give an answer because the law is completely ambiguous. It could be anything from a belligerent act. And just to give an example of what a belligerent act could be, on December 15th, Occupy sites all up and down the West Coast blockaded a series of ports.
Right.
If a foreign power were to blockade our ports, that would be a belligerent act. Is it a belligerent act if your own citizens do it? Who knows? And that is precisely the problem. And Judge Forrest said, if you can't tell people what would trigger this kind of detention, if it's just open to whatever the executive branch decides tomorrow will be problematic, that's not constitutional. And the problem, quite frankly, is that I don't think we can rely on the courts to uphold that decision. And so there is really a need both to reinforce that decision, but then also to raise the awareness of this law and to challenge it in all the different ways that we, the people of the United States, can.
So it was signed on December 31st, and then on May 16th, that provision was overturned. So does that mean that people cannot be picked up now by the NDAA? And has anyone ever been picked up by it, to our knowledge?
Great question. So as far as I know, no one has been picked up and detained under the NDAA, not because of the case, but because of the signing statement. President Obama, who to this point is the only president to have been in office under these provisions, has said that he won't use it. Now, the problem with the signing statement is it doesn't bind the administration in the future, even this one, let alone the next one. So whether it's in next year, you know, depending on the outcome of this upcoming election, or whether it's in 5 years, some other president will be in the White House. And if the NDAA's detention provisions are still on the books at that point, it's open season. Judge Forrest's ruling wasn't exactly overturning the law. It was a preliminary injunction. So she blocked it from taking effect.
Okay.
But the trial itself has yet to happen. It's still in process. And then even after that, there will be potential appeals when the government very well might take it up to a higher court. And, you know, whether the Second Circuit will uphold it is anyone's guess.
It was hard for me to find quotes from the president about the NDAA. How did his administration respond when the judge blocked it from taking effect?
You know, I don't think they said anything, as far as I know. There's even, you know, there's some speculation in D.C. that the Justice Department lawyers threw the case and wanted the injunction to happen for the same reason that the administration signed the signing statement, because they know that this law is more authoritarian than anything Bush or Cheney ever contemplated.
Then why? I mean, I don't want you to get into his head, but why would he sign this then?
It's the Defense Authorization Act. If he didn't sign the bill, remember, it's December 31st, 2011. So
right.
He waited until literally the 11th hour.
Right.
And it's the bill that authorizes the Pentagon. You have to sign it. I mean, the failure, I think, is Congress's in allowing such radical provisions to find their way into the bill. And there were several rounds of fights over amendments, and Congress made a choice to take a Soviet Chinese-inspired path rather than an American one.
And that is Shahid Batar. He's a civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And now I would like to welcome Daniel Ellsberg to the show. Again, Daniel, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and others filed the lawsuit to overturn the NDAA. Hi, Daniel. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's glad to be on, although I must say that if I hadn't been through this stuff before, the issues on this, what I just heard from Shahid would have killed my very chilling, because it does apply to me directly, I would say. I certainly am been very open public supporter of WikiLeaks, for example, and of Bradley Manning. Now, Bradley Manning is on trial right now, facing charges that amount to treason. And it could subject him in terms of the law to death, even though they're not claiming they're claiming they would not go for that, but definitely for life imprisonment, just as I faced 40 years ago in the Pentagon Papers trial. So in this case, though, I could be, as a supporter of Bradley Manning, and the law is vague enough to allow this, or as a supporter of WikiLeaks, which has been described by the head of the chairman of the Armed Services, of the Homeland Security Committee, Peter King, as a terrorist organization, which is absurd, but with that kind of designation, on suspicion of being supportive of this kind, I could be put in military detention. Now, in 40 years ago, my case was actually dismissed just before it went to the jury by the demonstration of a lot of government criminal activity against me, abusive behavior, which my judge said offended a sense of justice. It so happens Bradley Manning has been subject to that in spades with 10 and a half months in solitary confinement but he is subject to military. At least he's in a trial situation. In this situation, either he or I could be in detention without trial, without charges, indefinitely. Certainly, I wouldn't get out by reason of government criminality because there would be no basic hearing on that at all. I wouldn't have any basis at all. In other words, I feel directly affected by the implications of this law and the fact that this president claims as of now that he doesn't mean to apply it to people like me. Means virtually nothing. He could change that tomorrow, and certainly his successor would not be bound to it. But I'm saying even he would not be bound by it. So we definitely, this is one more step on a road away from constitutional government in this country.
Well, and Daniel, what are the implications of this law in our everyday lives? For example, we've had activists in the Occupy movement or the animal rights movement who say that they could be targeted. Sure. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. In effect, we're saying that people can be put away indefinitely without charges on the basis of suspicion of something or other. It could be some association with a terrorist group or an associated group. What is an associated group? As I'm saying, even Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks, who are very specific here, have been accused of giving aid and comfort. That's what Bradley Manning is accused of, for telling the truth, releasing troops to this country, just exactly what I did. If I'd been charged with that, which I wasn't, it would have been just as absurd as in his case. Could that be extended to groups that are as critical and as into direct action, nonviolent direct action, as Occupy? Certainly, I think, without any trouble. So it's a very, very authoritarian move, as I say, that goes further to trash the Constitution in the tradition of George W. Bush and Cheney.
Daniel, are you using your speakerphone by chance?
I am. It's not a speakerphone. If you're having trouble, you might want to call me on my landline downstairs. They called me on a cell phone.
Oh, all right. We'll call you on your landline. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
It'll take me a little to get down there.
Okay, we'll wait just a couple minutes. Sorry about that. Sometimes we get the cells and the landlines mixed up. And anyway, so Shahid, what are your thoughts about how this would apply today? We've got the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Conventions coming up, for example.
Right.
And the police forces are getting ready for these protests.
Yeah, they are. And I think there's a recent example in Chicago in the NATO summit
right. That
just happened a few months ago where, incidentally, Occupy demonstrators have been charged with terror offenses. That happened to five people since. And if the NDAA were in force at the time, rather than being held in shackles incommunicado from their lawyers for 3 days, which is what happened, which is itself a travesty that should make anyone, quite frankly, very concerned, they would be in a military brig. And so the status of the law at the moment is itself ambiguous, you know, for a few reasons. One is, you know, the status of a preliminary injunction by a district court in New York, for instance, and its effect over potential applications of the NDAA, say, not in the United States, but, say, Venezuela, right, where we also have the authority now to detain people without trial, is, I think, ambiguous. It creates a lot of confusion in the law, which is one reason why people have been so concerned about it. Just to broaden the equation here, it's not just offensive to civil liberties, and it's also offensive to national security. And the FBI's concern was exactly on this point that you raise. What do we do, asked the FBI at one point, if we pick up somebody like, say, the underwear bomber, right? Nigerian flies to the United States, tries to detonate a bomb on a flight to Detroit. This is December, I think, 2010. Might have been 2009. And if the NDAA were in force, it basically would mean that the FBI wouldn't have the right to detain him in a non-military space. The rhetoric surrounding the NDAA were basically hawks like Lindsey Graham, senator from South Carolina, or John McCain from Arizona, but also Democrats like Carl Levin from Michigan, who is the chief proponent of the military detention provisions. And their attitude is terrorists don't deserve trials. Well, the problem here is that, that's not actually what we're talking about. The question is whether or not people pursuing First Amendment activity get trials. And the answer is, under this law, no, they don't. But beyond that, it's who's a terrorist?
Right.
Right? And the law basically gives the executive branch the decision or the authority to decide who and to subject them to penalties without judicial process. And that, even short of the impact on the right to process, even short of the way that impacts and skews our political process, that in itself, denying due process and cutting out courts, giving the executive branch the unilateral authority to detain people, is the very essence of authoritarianism. It's always been the definition of it. And now we've welcomed those powers in a land that still sings baseball, you know, anthems of baseball games about being the land of the free.
Well, and so we're seeing mass arrests within the Occupy movement, for example, you name it. And so when we see arrests at the upcoming conventions, so the executive branch will decide, all right, we think that person might have ties to potential terrorists, so we're going to charge him or her under the NDAA?
So first of all, under the NDAA, you don't need a charge in the first place. So you just detain them under the NDAA. But I don't know if it would be necessarily, you know, that's another question. Is it going to be local prosecutors making that decision? Is it going to be the line cop on the street? Is it going to be the military intelligence people who are monitoring the Occupy movement? Is it going to be the FBI? Or is it going to be the Pentagon? No one has any idea. A, because the law has never been applied. We've never had a law like this in the United States, right? We used to be very proud of our constitutional tradition and our freedoms. So we're toying with powers that have become very well established in countries like China in the former Soviet Union. But because we've never used them, nobody really knows. A lot of these questions remain yet to be applied in practice. I would say on the subject of the conventions and mass arrests, there's another bill that already moved through Congress, not the NDAA, but the Trespass Act, which also escalates penalties for basically nonviolent dissent at events that are deemed of national significance. Anywhere where the Secret Service is deployed, which includes anywhere where a president or a presidential candidate speaks, is basically becoming a free speech free zone. Right, a no First Amendment zone, and that also should concern us. And I think that the Trespass Act is probably more likely to be applied at the conventions than is the NDAA, if only because of the signing statement and the judge's ruling. So there's at least two obstacles to the government trying to use the NDAA at the moment. But again, like Daniel noted, when the next president comes in, whether that's in 6 months or 5 years, all holds, you know, there's no holds barred, and even under this president, you know, the signing statement doesn't have the force of law, so they could change that decision at the drop of a hat.
That is Shahid Batar, a civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and he'll be on a panel tomorrow night at the Oakland Peace Center, 111 Fairmont, at 29th at 7 o'clock, and they'll be talking more extensively about the NDAA and our right to protest. We're also joined by Daniel Ellsberg, former U.S. military analyst, who released the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and other papers in 1971. Daniel, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and others filed the lawsuit to overturn the NDAA, alleging that it violates both their free speech and association rights guaranteed by the First Amendment. And if you have any questions about the NDAA, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. How does this affect our right to protest? Why do you think this isn't getting more attention? A lot of people say that if George W. Bush had signed the NDAA, a lot more people would know about it, and a lot more people would be talking about it. So what are your thoughts about that? And what do you think of President Obama's decision to sign this signing statement? The ACLU says the statement only applies to his administration, and again, it would not affect how the law is interpreted by future administrations. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So Daniel, why don't you tell us a little bit about your lawsuit, and how did you connect with Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges?
Well, I was called by the people running the suit at, I was very, and they asked me, you know, whether I felt that this would this law made me a plaintiff in the sense that it would chill my free speech, just having the law in practice. Well, my first reaction was, look, I'm too old to have my speech chilled by whatever any administration does. They can put me in jail. They can do whatever, but they can't shut me up. That was my confidence. But I was thinking about speaking in public, laying out an argument in public to the people, and I wasn't going to pull any punches on that, which, by the way, could have kept me from being a plaintiff. I say, well, it's not going to chill me, so it's no problem. But when I thought about it, I thought, wait a minute.
I have no doubt at all that my phone, like everybody else's essentially, is being recorded by the NSA now, thanks to the FISA Amendment, FISA Act Amendment clauses. I think the NSA and the Patriot Act and all the others, I think the NSA is basically recording just about everything and pulling it up when they need. When I thought about the fact that I often would be talking to, say, a lawyer in connection with Bradley Manning or Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, who's an I am definitely ready to go to jail for what I say to the public or what I write and make a case out of that, whether I win or lose. But I asked myself, am I ready to be detained without charges, put away, silenced, incommunicado, for something I've said over the phone, or will that affect what I'm willing to say over a phone? And that was easy to answer. It undoubtedly does affect what I'm willing to say in terms of free speech over a phone right now. That's just giving the government, this thing gives the government too much of a free swing at me if they ever want to put me away, because they could put me away for something I haven't chosen to say to the public, to inform the public something that I'm willing to risk my neck for, but just something I said in private to somebody that arises someone's suspicions of something. So, yes, it does. I would say it does chill my speech right now, since I am involved in speaking to people who are associated with the Bradley Manning and the WikiLeaks defense.
Well, we have a number of callers on this, so let's take a few before we go to break. Let's hear from Karen in Oakland. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Rose and Daniel. Thank you so much for bringing this up and spreading it out over the airwaves. And we're talking about Venezuela and the problem with South America and Bush and everything. But this is the exact agenda of Adolf Hitler in Berlin in 1933, establishing the Third Reich. This is the same kind of issues under Franco in Spain, Mussolini in Italy. And my father fought in World War II against the Nazis and against laws like the NDAA. So, yes, the government right now is gearing up to have armored tanks with turrets and rotating machine guns. And you should know that the Department of Homeland Security, as we speak, is trying to shove down the throat of every small town, including Berkeley. They tried to get this into Berkeley, and it was passed down. It was passed over. They tried to get the City of Berkeley Police Department to get, with a grant from Homeland Security, not for education, but for a tank for the police force, an armored tank with a turret and rotating machine guns, because they are gearing up for the regrouping of the 99% that will come up in September when school starts again all over the country. And that is what Obama is doing. It's unfortunate. That is what the Democrats are not standing up and speaking out against. And I am disgusted, and I am not frightened. I am angry. I am furious.
Well, thank you for calling in, Karen. We did a show about the militarization of police forces just a couple of months ago, and we've been seeing photos of a full-on military police with semi-automatic, or I don't know what they are, AK-47s in Anaheim, Shahid?
They have automatic weapons.
Yeah. And military tanks. So we'll be talking about that right after a break. And we're talking today about the NDAA. What questions do you have about it? How is this affecting our right to protest? Why did President Obama sign this? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or feedback at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Your Call on KLW, a show that depends on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org. We also find links to today's show. And that's where you can also sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our new newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Jerry Mander about his new book, The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. He argues that capitalism has had its day and has failed miserably, and it's time for us to move on. So do you agree? And if so, what is the alternative to capitalism? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the National Defense Authorization Act. It was signed by President Obama on December 31st. It codifies indefinite military detention without charge or trial for the very first time in American history. On May 16th, District Judge Catherine Forrest in Manhattan blocked that provision from taking effect. And that lawsuit was filed by Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and others. And today we are joined by Daniel Ellsberg, former U.S. military analyst, to release the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and other newspapers in 1971. We're also joined by Shahid Batar, a civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And Shahid will be speaking tomorrow night in Oakland on a panel about these issues at the Oakland Peace Center, 111 Fairmount at 29th. And this was put together by the San Francisco 99% Coalition. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can see it. And Shahid, you wanted to respond to what Karen said specifically about her father fighting in World War II.
Absolutely, and I think it's a really interesting example. Any veteran of World War II or any family that had veterans should be appalled by this law because it directly contravenes many of the values that we sought to establish there. And I find it very telling. The first of the, by this point, dozen local resolutions that have emerged around the country opposing the NDAA and its military detention provisions, the first one was passed by El Paso County, Colorado. And it's interesting, if you zoom in on El Paso County, Colorado, it includes the Air Force Academy, as well as several other military installations. This was the, and they passed this even before the NDAA became law. This was the middle of December when the Senate was still debating it. And their resolution by this county basically says, these are not the values that we've fought and died to defend. We've been sending our sons and daughters to die in wars for generations. And now we're actually allowing, through this law, a subversion of the most fundamental principles on which our country was built. And even before that, you know, to reference some of what Daniel was mentioning, the FISA law that allows the NSA to tap your phones and monitor your email accounts, that was sort of like losing the Cold War. And allowing torture with impunity, which the Obama administration has done in the wake of its commission by the Bush and Cheney regime, that was sort of like losing World War II because we're resigning the international human rights regime that we fought a world war to establish. The NDAA is like losing the American Revolution. Right. I mean, we're going all the way back to the beginning, and it is a recipe for just a very noxious mix. And in the wrong hands, it is the end of democracy as we know it.
The ACLU has an extensive list of resolutions. For example, Rhode Island, Hawaii. Where else are we seeing resolutions?
Arizona and Virginia have both passed them as well. So you see both red states and blue states, which I think is really interesting. Fairfax, California, here in the Bay Area, has passed a resolution. There's one in play at Berkeley. As we speak, going across the country, Tacoma Park, Maryland, right outside of D.C. where I live, Northampton, Massachusetts, jurisdictions from coast to coast and all points in between, three different counties in Colorado. It's interesting how Colorado has been particularly on it from the beginning. But this is an opportunity that anyone concerned about these issues can act on. And in fact, the event that we did yesterday at the Unitarian Universalist Center here in San Francisco included a discussion about a campaign to secure a similar resolution from the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. And that's a track that is available to anyone, even if our elected representatives in Congress are, sniffing salts or bath salts or what have you.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Karen. Oh, we have a comment from Stephen Short, who is KALW Cross Currents cannabis correspondent. And he says the U.S. does not need the NDAA to raid cannabis dispensaries. The U.S. attorney just says there is suspicion of wrongdoing. That's enough, suspicion.
And that's the issue in the NDAA is you don't need evidence. right? Because you don't have to charge people and they don't get a right to contest the evidence.
So then will we know, for example, okay, say at the Republican convention in Tampa Bay, Florida, coming up August 27th, we're probably going to see mass arrests. Will we know if someone is picked up under the NDAA? Do they have to even reveal that?
Fascinating question. And I've been saying this in the beginning. The answer is no. There are all kinds of things we don't know that our government does. The state secrets privilege has been used to shield everything from extrajudicial assassination to rendition, which is to say outsourcing torture to other countries, to tapping the phone lines and email accounts of law-abiding Americans. All these things have been effectively shielded through executive secrecy and the state secrets privilege. The very same tools could be used to hide the fact of anyone's detention. So if the next whistleblower is detained because they're going to release embarrassing secrets to or secrets that would be embarrassing to the government, you and I might never hear about it.
Well, and Daniel, we hardly ever hear about Bradley Manning. I mean, unless you're involved in his campaign directly, he's hardly ever in the news.
Well, as I understand it, the latest word I heard is his trial has probably been put off. I think it was supposed to be in October. Till early spring, by the government. I don't understand this, and maybe I have it wrong even, but the way my understanding is that the government is continuing to delay on this. He will have been in trial very possibly almost 3 years without having been in detention for almost 3 years without having been brought to trial. But if I can comment on a couple of things that just passed, both the previous caller and Shahid's comments may have raised analogies that seem unduly ominous, 1933 in Germany, Franco, elsewhere. I don't think they are at all, actually. They're absolutely appropriate. When Shahid mentions that we fought the revolution, not only World War II, in support of rights like this, that's one can go a little further than that. My understanding is that George III, the king emperor that we fought a revolution against, did not have the legal rights that are asserted in this law, as a matter of fact. I think you have to go back to John I and before the Magna Carta to really, it's wiping out like 800 years of civil liberties history here to say that a government can put somebody into prison indefinitely without charges, without due process of any kind. It's the very foundation, I'd say, of any kind of accountable or Republican or Democratic constitutional government, that they can't do that. That's a line you can't cross. And in fact, Congress has just proposed to cross it. The president is going along with that. I must say that going back almost, more than 10 years now to 2001, to 9/11, I was afraid with the first acts that passed there, in the wake of the anthrax attack that has never been explained out of government laboratories here somewhere, somebody, Congress passed the Patriot Act and other measures. I was saying then and ever since, we're not a police state yet, and that's true now. We're not yet what could be, I think, properly called a police state by any means, or I wouldn't be on the air here, and nor would Shahid. We'd be in detention already.
Right.
But the infrastructure for a police state has been constructed step by step, very, very thoroughly. This is almost the culmination of it. And I must say that years ago I was saying, we're not a police state, but with one more 9/11, which fortunately we haven't had in this country, but with one more, I expect us to be one overnight. Well, to my amazement, it hasn't taken a 9/11. The extension of surveillance, I would say, has gone about as far as it can go. I think that the NSA and the others are sweeping up about everything there is to be recorded, whether it's credit card information, emails, faxes, phone calls, whatever. I doubt if that can go much further. What hasn't happened yet is mass detention, and certainly another 9/11. We have the actual basis for that right now. One last thing: when we talk about these conventions, already in the last two conventions, I've been absolutely appalled by the treatment of the so-called free speech centers, where they pen people up behind wire,
right. Wire
fences. I didn't ever want to see that in America, and it does chill my blood to see it. It's disgusting, and I think we can expect that sort of treatment today. Certainly, I don't think people should accept to be penned up in free speech enclosures like animals, with in to keep any representatives from hearing what they have to say.
Well, and just to let listeners know what it looks like, I went to the RNC convention in New York. I think it was 2004.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. We were walking in front of a hotel where they were having a party, and about 10 cops with billy clubs charged me with my press pass, had a computer kind of over my shoulder. And it was at night, and they said, "You're not allowed to walk down this sidewalk. Go into the free speech zone." I was walking with a few people with signs interviewing them, and they had a cage across the street. And they said, if you continue walking, you will be arrested. And I didn't want to be arrested. The people with me continued walking. They got arrested. And they said, "You've got to cross the street. Go into the cage."
There's some freedom of the press for you.
This was in 2004.
It's only gotten worse since.
Well, so what rights do we have? Because I just got an email from Leslie in Berkeley who says, "One sadly effective purpose of this act is to further inhibit dissent, especially about U.S. foreign policy. I'm a college teacher, and many of my students have, even before this act, been afraid to even sign a petition."
This is why we once had a First Amendment that had meaning, right? It used to be that the whole country was a free speech zone, and the reason that we have those principles, the reason that we once had privacy, was to enable dissent. The Constitution is an elaborate structure aimed to protect the operation of our democracy, and the central tenet of that, I think, is this notion that people have to be free to embrace unpopular ideas. And whether it's through a pervasive surveillance regime, or whether it's now through the escalation of that national security state to allow the tools for mass detention, whether it's through the routine now, quite frankly, restrictions on First Amendment rights, the freedom of assembly means nothing in this country anymore. I was in Occupy Oakland on October 25th, you know, and that I saw very visibly what the First Amendment meant, ironically, after lecturing at UC Berkeley on it that same afternoon. And, you know, the Occupy movement demonstrates, I think, as visibly as we might care to see, how meaningful or meaningless the First Amendment has become.
So what rights do we have?
Very few. I mean, I would say we have the rights that we're able to fight to secure. And I certainly don't mean that in a violent context, but I mean the rights that we secure are the ones that we have. And we can't rely on courts to defend them. Our federal courts are pretty co-opted in this endeavor. We can't rely on Congress to defend them, right? Not only has Congress abandoned the oversight mission with which it's constitutionally charged, but at every opportunity to enlarge and further aggrandize the executive, Congress marches in lockstep. And even now, under the Obama administration with a Democratic-led Senate, you still get these kind of neoconservative laws like the NDAA. And I have to be honest, a lot of us in D.C., we're sitting around scratching our heads, even people on the Hill. You know, I've had conversations with senior legislative aides who are mystified as to how this happened, because it's all in the shadows. There was never a single hearing on this bill at any point in its legislative history. And yet now it's a law. And, you know, there are plenty. The End Racial Profiling Act's been in Congress for 10 years. There have been tons of hearings. We can't get that into a law somehow. But
what about politicians themselves? Are the aides saying that their bosses are mystified by this?
A lot of them are mystified about what they signed. I've seen printed op-eds by members of Congress mischaracterizing the provisions of the bill. A lot of them don't understand, quite frankly, what they're legislating, which is a problem in itself.
Well, right? We hear that a lot, that they don't even read the bills because they're so long. Well, we have a question from Stacey, who couldn't stay on. She wants to know specifically which committees or politicians initiated the NDAA and support it as is.
The Armed Services Committee was the sort of originating committee. Its chief proponents are Carl Levin, Democrat from Michigan, and John McCain, Republican from Arizona. The entire Armed Services Committee, though, has generally voted in favor of this bill against the concerns from lots of other corners, including, again, the Pentagon, the DNI, the FBI, the White House. The Intelligence Committee, Senator Feinstein from here in California, has been very critical of the indefinite detention provisions and has a bill called the Due Process Guarantee Act that would aim to ameliorate it. I do want to mention that it has many problems that could render it a cure worse than the disease. Representative Garamendi, also from here in California, has a stronger bill called the Civil Liberties Act, which would be more effectively repeal the detention provisions. And there have been some other very leading lights in both houses. Senator Mark Udall has been very loud in championing the liberty interests here, as have many Republicans, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Justin Amash in the House. These are all Republicans who've been very outspoken and assertive about the constitutional rights at stake here. And we've seen bipartisan coalitions emerge in both the House and the Senate every time these provisions have come up. So you have both Democrats and Republicans on both sides of the issue. And so it really does muddy the waters.
Right. Well, right. You have a lot of libertarians who are adamantly opposed to this, in many cases speaking out more than progressives.
Absolutely. I'd say the libertarians are leading, with progressives catching up and the establishment co-opted on both sides.
And Daniel, I wanted you to respond to Leslie. I don't know if you heard her email, but she's a college teacher, and she says many of her students are afraid to even sign petitions nowadays. What would you say to her and her students?
Oh, boy. Well, I face that to a certain extent, you know, all this time going. I lived through the McCarthy period, but then during my trial, there were 20,000 people did actually contribute in small amounts to my trial at a time with their name on it, often on checks. And some didn't want to sign it, but a lot of people did sign it at a time when the president was saying this was endangering the country, which is untrue, and people decided to stand up. I think unless people are willing to stand up and together and take these risks, in other words, I'm not going to say the risk is unreal. Everything we've been implying here is to say that there is some risk, but as Shahid says, struggle, nonviolent struggle here, and democratic and free speech struggle, I would say, including nonviolent direct action in many cases, is necessary to preserve these liberties. When you ask what rights we still have, well, we still are conducting this program. I wouldn't doubt that there are people in the administration and in the Congress who could listen to what we said on this program and say we're opposing the these measures for national security, we're giving aid and comfort to enemies of the United States, suspect that and close us down, in effect, or come after us. But that hasn't happened yet. And I think that the answer to the question you pose is, unless people throughout their lives are willing to take risks to preserve our rights, we won't have them. And that's worth doing.
That is Daniel Ellsberg, former U.S. military analyst who released the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and other papers in 1971. Be sure to see the amazing documentary, The Pentagon Papers, if you haven't already. Daniel, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and others filed a lawsuit to overturn the NDAA. And on May 16th, District Judge Catherine Forrest in Manhattan blocked the controversial provision from taking effect. And that provision would authorize the president and all future presidents to order the military to pick up and indefinitely imprison people captured anywhere in the world. We're also joined by Shahid Batar, a civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And Shahid will be speaking on a panel tomorrow night at the Oakland Peace Center, 111 Fairmount at 29th. And we've got about 6 or so minutes left. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, if you have a question or a comment about the NDAA and our right to protest, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. The right to assemble, the right to speak out on any number of issues. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I recall when I heard the Defense Authorization Act was passed, I recall a brief little mention that there was another poison pill for democracy buried in there, and then the story died before anyone even got around to explaining what that was. And your program is the first time, you know, with Daniel and Shahid, I think, the other guest, explaining this, that I actually understand how sweeping this thing is. And in my opinion, it's intended to end the right to nonviolent street protest, because if anyone can be accused of terrorism based on no definition, then that really is the end of the right to free assembly and to march down the street. And we have no political representation that opposes this on a national level in the form of, I mean, the president's signing statement is the most weaselly excuse for an evasion of his responsibility, because as has already been explained, it has no legal authority at all. It's a meaningless thing that George Bush found convenient, and now little Obama has decided to use it too. I'm just really shocked. This really is the end of the legal foundation for democracy. We've already lost habeas corpus. That started with the Magna Carta about 1,000 years ago. There is no way to exaggerate the importance of this if it isn't overturned. That was my principal comment.
Well, thank you for calling in, Kevin, and we'll get a comment after we take a few more calls. Let's hear next from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, Daniel, and Shahid. The fact is, I've been speaking about this issue for many, many years, and nobody paid attention. The war on terror is really war against the American people. It has been. Somebody has to really look into 9/11. Al-Qaeda and all of this bunch of losers really are very weak and not very connected groups, and they've been used mostly by elements we're talking about. We are not police state yet, but we are in the process of being one. The fact is, you have to look at the Project for New American Century, 1998. You have to look at the whole conservative movement, which have been pulling the control for George W. Bush and Obama. I think what we should do, why are we not marching in millions in the street as the Egyptian has? It is very dangerous for a few people. But obviously, it is peril. What is happening with this whole thing, peril, the biggest ripoff in history, the total collapse of the American economy that was taken over by the few. So what you do, you take the money and you have the police, crash their heads.
Well,
so this is exactly what is happening, Rose. We have to have millions of people in the street, and Obama should surrender his peace Nobel Prize, because he definitely does not deserve it.
Well,
totally failed us.
Thank you for calling in, Eid. We'll get a comment in just a minute, right after we hear from Larry in Berkeley. Hi, Larry.
Oh, hi. Listen, Larry Everest, Revolution Newspaper. First, I'm glad Daniel and Shahid are speaking out against this and that the suit was filed. I have one very specific example of what you've been talking about, the potential suppression of legitimate political speech and activity, because in this overall positive ruling in the case, insinuated into this was a reference to the Revolutionary Communist Party and its chairman, Bob Avakian, which was erroneous and potentially really harmful and could be used as a pretext to criminalize constitutionally protected freedom of speech and association and sweep the RCP and Avakian into a category identified by the government as terrorists, which is blatantly false. And I think the Daniel earlier mentioned the experience of Nazi Germany and that this wasn't too far afield. I totally agree with him. And one of the things we learned there was that it's very dangerous to allow the government to determine who is a legitimate organization and who isn't. I've been listening to the show, and there's Occupy, there's the Palestinian movement, there's WikiLeaks, there's Bradley Manning, all these different very important groups. It can't be up to the government to peel one group off from another. And I, as I think we've all heard the Pastor Niemöller statement, first they came for the communists, then I didn't speak up, and he goes through then the trade unionists, the Jews, and so on. So we can't allow this to happen. And circulated condemning this. I'd urge people to go to revcom.us.
Thank you for calling, Larry. We're almost out of time, so I want to be sure we have enough time for comments. Shahid, what was the reference to the Communist Party?
It was in Judge Forrest's ruling.
Okay.
And it's interesting, the Pastor Niemöller quote that Larry cited, it's ironic because first they came for the Communists was the first of the litany, and it was the first of the litany then that progressed, and it seems to be the first in the litany now, again, except that they already came for the environmentalists and the Muslims, so we're sort of well down the road.
And in our remaining minute, this issue is not getting attention at all in the presidential campaign. It hardly gets attention in progressive circles. What are your overall thoughts about President Obama's record on civil liberties?
It's a travesty. I wrote an article just a week ago called America's One Party State, because on these issues, We live in a one-party state because there is no daylight between the Democratic or Republican parties. And that's a real problem. One-party states we have always recognized as authoritarian for even other reasons beyond the military detention authority, right? I mean, we are in multiple dimensions racing headlong toward an authoritarian future. And that should concern anyone who values freedom or justice or equality, for that matter. Last thing I just say is that this August is a key opportunity because members of Congress leave Washington every August to return home to their districts. This happens to be a presidential election year. August is the point at which your members of Congress are the most exposed to grassroots criticism and concern. And because it's a presidential election year, politics is being discussed. So this is probably the most important month of the last 4 years coming up. And so if people are concerned about these issues, this is a great time to reach out to your member of Congress's office to schedule a meeting or to write an op-ed or to do a march or a protest. This is a great time to shift the national debate with local action here in the Bay Area.
And they go on recess August?
I think it's the 6th.
6th, okay. Thank you. And Daniel Ellsberg, final thoughts on this?
Well, I've agreed with everything that Shahid had to say. He's very eloquent on it. With perhaps, I want to make one modification there at the end. In the matters that we've been discussing on civil liberties, it's true. The two parties have been virtually indistinguishable, and that's also true to a large extent in foreign policy. I have to say that when it comes to domestic policy, in many respects, we have two terrible, inexcusable parties, and one of them is even worse than the other.
I'll agree with that.
I can't accept the idea that it makes no difference whether Romney gets elected or not. I know many of the readers, many of our listeners will disagree with me vociferously on this point, but that's where I stand. I believe Romney and the Republicans would be even worse.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And so in terms of taking action, August is really the time to speak your voice about the NDAA. Use your voice.
It does present a great opportunity.
All right. Thank you. Daniel Ellsberg is a former U.S. military analyst who released the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times in 1971. And he filed a lawsuit to overturn the NDAA with Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and others. Shahid Batar is a civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And Shahid will be on a panel tomorrow night at the Oakland Peace Center, 7 o'clock, 111 Fairmount at 29th. Shahid and Daniel, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Is the age of capitalism over? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Jerry Mander, author of The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. Mander argues that capitalism has had its day and has failed miserably. It's killing the planet, dismantling democracy, promoting wars, and making us less happy. Do you agree? And if so, what is the alternative to capitalism? How do you define it? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malia Hayraz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and David Latulip is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.